Here's a cool fact. A crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Another cool fact, you can get short-term health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans are designed for people who are between jobs, coming off their parents' plan, or turning a side hustle into a full-time gig. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. Get more cool facts about UnitedHealthcare short-term plans at uh1.com.
It's that time of the year. Your vacation is coming up. You can already hear the beach waves, feel the warm breeze, relax, and think about work. You really, really want it all to work out while you're away. Monday.com gives you and the team that peace of mind. When all work is on one platform and everyone's in sync, things just flow. Wherever you are, tap the banner to go to Monday.com.
Hello, I'm Helen.
And I'm Stephen.
And today we have an extra special, long, extended Brexit remix, where we talk about all the issues that have been dominating the headlines this week. I've forgotten how we start the podcast, Stephen. This is what happens when we don't have India.
So what we do is we start the podcast by, in this instance, me saying we are, in fact, going to talk about Brexit.
Wait, no, we're going to talk first of all about your award, which I think podcast listeners will be very excited to hear about. Last night, Stephen won Political Journalist of the Year, or even maybe actually Journalist of the Year.
Yeah.
Screw all those guys doing, like, environment correspondence. Who even are they?
There was no modifier.
At the Political Studies Association. Oh, and it was a really nice event, actually. We got to see NS favourite James Graham, you know, that we've previously been in the pay of Big Graham advertising his play.
And sadly, Harry's and their German factory were nowhere to be seen.
Yanis Varoufakis unfortunately did not appear, but you know, other friends of the podcast were there. Grayson Perry, a previous guest editor of the NS, was there. So it was a nice evening was had by all, in the case of the all being me and you. So congratulations, Stephen. One of the things that was in your citation was the fact that you sang on the podcast. So if you want at the end of this perhaps to give us a few bars of something, that would be entirely appropriate. I'll leave you to think about that.
Okie dokie.
Talking about someone who's seen the inside of a few bars, David Davis.
Oh, wow, that's brutal.
Come on.
Yeah, so Brexit. Well, so the fascinating thing about the kind of state of the Brexit talks is I am actually feeling a lot more optimistic about them. Now, whether or not this is a post-awards afterglow, I'm not entirely sure.
Yeah, what you've done is you've met actual normal humans who are quite competent and sensible, and therefore you've now topped up your optimism reserve, right? Whereas actually, if you just read about things that are happening, you go, these people are all Muppets. We're never going to get out. This is crazy.
I know listeners will be going, but it seems things are going quite badly. Just to recap, at the time that we are listening, Theresa May kind of got her sort of announcing a deal face on, hopped over to Brussels, did all of the glad handing. Midway through, the DUP went, I'm sorry, you've signed an agreement where we regulatorily diverge from the United Kingdom without consulting us.
Did we not put the name in the party name? Like, yeah. Did you not see what we're about here, people? And David Davis has been in front of the Brexit Select Committee admitting that the reports that he said were in such excruciating detail that Theresa May couldn't have read them do not, in fact, exist at all.
Yeah.
Such excruciating imaginary detail that she couldn't read them.
Yes.
So that's all a bit clown shoes.
Now, basically, I mean, the Irish border is something which makes my head hurt, not because it's complex, but because increasingly I don't understand what it is the average Conservative Brexiteer wants out of the Brexit process, right? If you have a separate regulatory regime, i.e. if you are free, if you have reclaimed your sovereignty and you have the right to strike your own trade deals, i.e. you've left the customs union, you have a regulatory and customs frontier on the island of Ireland, or if you decide because of the historical sensitivities of that border that you don't want it there, you have it in the Irish Sea. If there is any incentive to anyone to sign a trade deal with the United Kingdom, you have to be able to enforce your customs frontier. That's before you get to the fact that the WTO makes both sides enforce your customs frontier, and the success of the European Union, whether you like the political constraints that come with it or not, isn't it effectively is an exclusionary trade body. That is the success of it in terms of generating and maximising economic growth within it, right?
But this is what you said on the podcast last week about the idea that the Brexiteers aren't serious. And this is what, I know, this is kind of an ongoing lesson in the dangers of populism, right? Which is that you win something through sloganeering. And what you don't do, which is the fundamental job of politics to do, is you ever explain to people that there are advantages and disadvantages to every course of action. You pretend that it can be absolutely 100% upside. I'm saying this because I went back and reread a hilarious speech by Michael Gove from April 2016, in which he says, what kind of crazy bunch of fools would trigger Article 50 and this countdown process before really knowing what they wanted? And you're like, meet that crazy bunch of fools, Michael Gove, there and called your party.
But, so despite the fact that someone else in the lobby, who I won't name because they don't want to, you know, sabotage any relationships for them, said to me, oh, well, the thing you've got to look forward to when you have children is then you'll have trained yourself by talking to pro-Brexit MPs. They said, apparently at one point when their oldest was three, he would get upset because he'd be eating something and there'd be less food. And this went on for about, and they, one of those things where he said, which is funny now, but at the time you're like, is this going to end? But the thing is, like, that is the story of a child whose brain hadn't yet fully developed. There are no pro-Brexit MPs whose brains are not fully developed, right? So they have literally no excuse. However, despite that, I think the prospects of a more sensible Brexit are actually increasing, partly because the only group of Brexiteers who have a plan in the, well, there are two groups of Brexiteers who have a plan in the UK. People who want a kind of so-called left exit from the European Union, but they're obviously in opposition. So them having a plan is, you know, nice, but they can't really do anything with it. And then your kind of EEA model people. Now, the EEA has lots of problems. Not least, it is hard to argue that it is not deeply against the spirit of why a majority of the majority voted to leave.
I don't think that's true in the case of the customs union. I think it's true in the case of the single market. I think you have to treat them quite separately because I think, you know, it's about economics and immigration, the promise of more money for public services and the promise of, you know, less change in communities and the promise of giving a hefty kick to all politicians, right? So that's this is why I find this particular discussion so enervating. It's just going, just stay in the customs union. The idea that in 20 years' time we'll sign a tedious trade deal with Singapore is not worth all of this, guys.
Yeah, I mean, you do also have to have some regulatory alignment as well. But it is true that the problem of the Irish border is not an inevitable problem of the Brexit vote.
No, and who really cares about the ECJ apart from the Tory party? I mean, I said this on the Daily Politics. And I had lots of like people who were called like Patriot 973 saying, actually, I voted because of sovereignty. And you kind of think, well, maybe, OK, so maybe 30 to 40 people did that as well as the Tory party. But like we have good statistical evidence about what drove that vote. And it is, by and large, it is not the ECJ.
Yeah, although, I mean, so there are lots and lots and lots of reasons why governments should not hold referendum if they are not in favour of the change proposition. There were lots of things in the Scottish government's white paper on independence that I think were overly optimistic. But nonetheless, if Scotland had voted yes, there would have been a clear understanding what the, not just the proposition of are we going to leave the United Kingdom YN, but a clear understanding of the assumptions under which people who were voting yes had decided to proceed.
Yeah, well, they had like 150-page, what was it called, yeah. Scotland's Future. I mean, I've got a signed copy at home. That's how nerdy I am.
Yeah, wow, well done you. It's
worth 3 to 4 pence on eBay.
In any case, we would be in a better position if the government had to kind of have some idea what it is people wanted. And the problem, again, because the margin was so small, then basically any random group, I mean, it's why that ridiculous take about, oh, you know, this is really about, like, left behind voters. Like, well, that is the story of the voters who decided that we left, right? If you want to identify the group of people who are
The swing,
yes, that is a good take. If you want to, so it's great for explaining why 2 million people voted to leave. If you want to explain why the remaining 15 million did, it's not a great one. Now, the thing about the EEA option is you can make a strong argument that there are about a million people, and you only need 600,000 to tip the result one way or the other, a million people for whom that is a leave version that they actively kind of wanted. And then obviously you can kind of then add that onto the 48% of people who voted for no change and go, the EEA is the unity option. Now, I am deeply uncomfortable with that for, like, upholding democratic elections way. And I kind of think at the point you're ignoring why people left, can we just not stay in? But the reason why I now think it is significantly more likely that will happen is
because... But if you do leave to EEA, that does... I mean, you have left the political structures at that point. And actually, you're much more in control then of, if you want, over a period of many years afterwards to do further stuff, right? That to me is the kind of key thing. So you are definitely leaving the EU and beginning the start of that process. It could just be a very long process of then at that point pulling apart.
Yeah. And the interesting thing is, although in terms of what the leaders of the parties are saying, it's like, oh no, you know, the DUP and the Conservatives are miles apart. The most significant thing that happened this week in terms of the prospects of a deal was that Ruth Davison kind of went, no, yeah, if regulatory alignment is the price we pay for a frictionless border, which of course she knows full well that it is.
And we want it everywhere.
Then we have to do that as one united kingdom. The Scottish Conservative Party has basically said, yes, we agree with our leader. But the more significant thing is Geoffrey Donaldson quote tweeted it and went, well said, at Ruth Davison.
Who is the chief whip
of the DUP.
But also, once again, you look at the Conservative Party in Scotland, and the clue is in the name. It is a Conservative and Unionist Party in Scotland, right? Her electoral incentives are all about not being the SNP. So she knows that that's... as a tactical move about her future and the future of the Scottish Tory Party, that is clear.
Yeah. I think the thing about the Brexit ultras in the Conservative Party is they can't tear the house down. They are not going to vote for an election.
They're also not very well whipped. This is the thing I think is kind of fascinating, right? The DUP, for all that there are many things I disagree with them on, are a tight block, right? They act as what, I mean, apart from occasionally they let some people go a bit off the reservation, but they are quite disciplined, whereas the Brexiteers are not.
I think that was the fascinating thing about the collapse of the talks was reading through all of the newspapers, not just the ones in Westminster, where regrettably in some cases the interest in the DUP is not one what one might expect, not least because although this is the first time they've been actively involved in government, it was clear in 2010 that the challenge of winning a majority was quite hard, so they might need the DUP then. In 2015, the polls suggested that there would be a difficult... So again, there was a reason to find out who these people were.
Yeah.
And now
any
they
sort
are...
of decent-sized rebellion in 2015, you would have needed them to offset that.
Yeah. I mean, this thing, so, like, there is no excuse for the level of DUP that emanates from a large chunk of the commentary.
What was the size of the rebellion against Labour's first tuition fee? I mean, it was...
Oh, it was huge because they passed it by something like 4 votes.
I know, it was like 80 people. I mean, the Parliament has got systematically more rebellious, but in a more like low-level frothy way, right?
Now they
just junk stuff off the side of the cliff. I mean, that's the, you know, because they don't have, they just know already they don't have the majority for it.
But yeah, that was, you know, a tight vote than the government could have fallen over tuition fees, right? It was incredibly close.
Despite a majority in triple figures.
Yeah.
Great, because it was before 2005.
Yeah, it was before 2005.
Yeah.
Want flexibility? Take yoga. Want flexibility with your health insurance? Check out United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly medical, dental, and vision coverage that may be right for you. More at uh1.com.
The fascinating, I mean, there are many fascinating things, some of which we've kind of already talked over in previous episodes, but I think the kind of new thing, and it's worth observing about Brexit, is basically like, what is the SNP and Plaid Cymru's political objective? It is independence or a greater level of self-determination if you're a kind of incremental Welsh nationalist. And their EU policy flows through that, one, because it is a good wedge issue if you are the SNP to point to the fact that Scotland is being taken out against its will, but also because if you are a small nation in Europe, you cannot have a functioning independent economy if you are not in the EU in the single market, right? So that kind of makes sense from their political objectives perspective.
I was going to say, what about Iceland? Now I remember that literally, like, Iceland has got the same population as a mid-sized town in Britain.
And
so
also,
it's sort of...
and also, I mean, this is... And I suspect this will be another interesting issue in phase two of the talks. The thing about countries which aren't in the EU, it's a bit like, oh, well, we'll left the EU, we'll be like Norway or Switzerland or Iceland. There are just good arguments that the extent to which those nations are not in the EU
is utterly fig leaf.
Yeah, like...
Yes, Switzerland, which is surrounded on all sides by people who are in the EU, accepts a huge amount of regulatory convergence.
Yeah, it's just like, you know, it just feels to me that, yeah, okay, clearly some people do really care about whether or not the word EU appears in front of something, but... It is very difficult to make the case. I mean, okay, there's obviously a kind of, you know, nameplate argument for why they're not in the EU. But in terms of the policy objections that most Brexiteers have, it is not overly clear to me what the problem with the EU then is fixed by the Norway or Switzerland option, other than the political project bit. That makes sense. What is Labour's objective? It is to, depending on which bit of the Labour Party you are talking to, it is to create socialism, reform capitalism, rebuild social democracy. And their Brexit objective fits...
No, wait. No, I'm not... Because I think their Brexit objective is, we're not here. All the lights are turned up. It's basically me on Halloween. Like, I'm not in...
That is Labour's combined Brexit objective. But basically, the thing is depending on which one of those is your objective, that then leads you to a different Brexit objective.
It was pretty astonishing that in that GQ interview with Jeremy Corbyn, where he said that he hadn't discussed with Seamus Milne, his director of strategy, like how he voted in the referendum. Like, I wouldn't ask him, that's a very personal question, was his answer. And you're kind of like, okay. But I think that's, to me, is kind of fascinating. Like, you know, obviously... You know, that Jeremy Corbyn voted against the Lisbon Treaty, voted against Maastricht. He says, you know, he was a kind of 7 out of 10.
Single European Act.
Yeah, he was a 7 out of 10 on the staying in. And, you know, and they spun that as being, well, that's kind of where most of the country was. But I'm surprised that...
Well, to be fair, most of the country was actually 4.8% out of 10.
Yeah, that's very true. But I don't know. I find their position slightly hard to swallow at the moment. What they're doing, I think, might be very good politics. I think it's sort of sad for the country. Because I think people deserve representation, and I think the job of an opposition is also that is a job in itself, and to do scrutiny and to pick holes in government arguments. And I think sort of saying, you know, we'll be out back, come get us when we're needed to do a bit of governing. I find that quite difficult to accept. I agree that probably tactically it probably is the right thing to do.
I also think the thing is that, like, although that is kind of the collective position which the whole of Labour can rally around, right? Then basically, the bits of the Labour Party which think that we should leave either because they think it's a necessary evil or they think it's a prerequisite, whatever.
It just feels like
I think Labour's collective Brexit position is a lot more craven than any of the individual parts of it.
Because also they've just been very slow on things, right? So you've now got Keir Starmer saying we should put the single market and the customs union back on the table. Well, you know, where were you when the vote on that was happening and you actually had resignations from your shadow cabinet over it? Or the fact that they went along with that mad clamour about triggering Article 50 at a time when you could have put your hand in the air and said, I don't think we should do this until the government's sort of, you know, obviously we all know that we need to leave and run on the referendum result, but we want to hear more detail about how you're going to solve X, Y, Z. Here is our 5-point test about triggering Article 50. Until the government can tell us these 5 things, we're not going to do it.
So my unpopular opinion about triggering Article 50 is it's a really interesting example of collective failure, right? Because it was a disaster by the government and a disaster by the opposition, viewed through the lens of the Brexit process, to do it in that way, in that manner.
And one that was entirely foreseen, as I said, by Michael Gove, by saying what kind of crazy bunch of fools would do it without knowing what they wanted.
But with the exception of Michael Gove, I actually can't... It's one of those things where I cannot work out who the group of people who I think could plausibly have done anything different, other than actually, right, the people who I think are to blame are that core of the vote leavers who had fought a referendum saying no, this would be a crazy way of doing it, who did have a sympathetic ear in the right-wing press.
Yeah.
But once you don't have Michael Gove and Yusuf Stewart and Boris Johnson using that influence in order to prevent it, the idea that any Conservative leader can resist it is nonsense. Once a Conservative leader has started that music, the idea that any Labour leader could meaningfully have... Yeah, ultimately, the thing about Labour's whipping position on EU issues is they basically make the difference as far as the votes of, I would say, at best... 12 MPs on the front bench who would switch their vote if they were allowed to vote in a more pro-European direction. And then perhaps on the back benches, there are a couple of people who are slightly more Eurosceptic than they let on, who the fact that they can nestle under Corbyn's umbrella of the fact that Labour activists like him to go, oh, well, you know, I always follow the whip, some of those people would probably feel pressured by their local party to still follow the whip. But the vast undertow of what happened with Article 50 on both sides, and both the Conservative and the Labour Party, once you have a Conservative leader who I just cannot come up with a plausible case for how they could have avoided doing it, everyone else kind of has to do what they have to do.
It just reminds me a bit of when George Osborne used to do those, you know, amazing dividing lines that we were all so impressed that, you know, Ed Balls hadn't fallen into the trap and Labour had voted on this, you know, way that was unpopular with their activists in order to do it. And in hindsight, you just think, then Jeremy Corbyn came along and went like, no, I'm not going to do it. I'm going to spend loads of money. What of it?
Although Labour did also, let's face it, like also do that. I see that trap. I'm not. Yeah, we should not forget that the 27 manifesto included a commitment that freedom of movement would end.
Yeah, that's true.
And did not go into the election going, yeah, we are the party which, yeah, like, yeah. But you know what I mean? You can its fiscal baseline supports the welfare cap. So they did similarly avoid those two dividing.
But sometimes you can be like, I'm so clever, I haven't fallen into your trap. When actually you think, you make a bet instead, in the long term, people are going to come around to my position that I was right all along. So I'm going to take the hit in the short term and trust that we become
out,
right?
I want to do the Lib Dems now,
which
right.
is like the Iraq war. Yeah. Thing. But, you go, you'll agree, give me a couple of 5 years and you'll all agree with me it was a bad idea.
So the thing with the Lib Dems, right, is their political objectives are, one, to expunge some of the...
To survive.
Well, yes, but to survive, but to do that by, one, expunging the kind of smell of coalition and the idea that they have no values by going, well, look, here is a big value. And also, crucially, because they want to a greater or lesser extent... defend the European social model and the UK's economic model, which you can really only do by backing either a Remain vote or a very, very I can't believe it's not Brexit.
But I think they've got a huge problem in Lib Dems in the sense that one of the things that is the smell that kind of did for them in the last election is homosexuality a sin, Tim Farron. And, you know, this comes back to the argument that we had when we did our centenary issue about did the left or the right win the 20th century, and about on social issues, absolutely progressives have won and repeatedly won over and over again. So if you're the Lib Dems and you're trying to, you know, get away from that idea, we know lots of social progressives who were quite pro-European, probably more aligned with the Lib Dems, still voted Labour. What is the emblematic social progressive issue now that they can do at a time when, you know, gay people can marry, they can adopt? There isn't that kind of big, huge, lingering injustice for them to kind of definitively draw a line in the sand from the Farron era, right?
Yeah, partly because the party's platform on paper was already quite socially liberal, so there's not something, but...
I mean, the obvious one would be transgender issues, but Jeremy Corbyn is already at the kind of ultimate, you know, end of that. There is no space beyond him that you could outmaneuver him on that.
Yeah, I mean, they could just talk about it more, right? There is a large constituency of people who are very upset about what's happening with Trump, with Brexit, with the vocabulary towards immigration, and they could...
Well, they could be a pro-immigration party. It could be I mean, that would definitely... there is space to outflank Labour progressively there on freedom of movement.
But I think the thing is right, regardless of whether or not the Liberal Democrat position on Europe worked, and it obviously did not from an electoral perspective, in terms of their political and economic objectives, their Brexit position makes sense. Now, the fascinating thing I think about the Brexit position is... And I honestly would really love to hear listeners' opinions on this... What are the Conservatives' political objectives? What are their Brexit objectives? And at what point do those two circles meet? And it seems to me that the answer to that question is they don't. If you are a economically liberal or Thatcherite Conservative, ultimately the Conservatives' Brexit asks are going to end up with Britain being a more protectionist country than it is today. If you are a pro-union Conservative, it self-evidently puts more pressure on the Union of Crowns. I am yet to find a Conservative ideological and electoral aim in which the... Yeah, because say what you like about all of the other political parties, they have successfully got to a point where those two circles entirely align.
Yeah, and I think there's an additional problem for the Conservatives, which is that everybody thinks, you know, if you talk about people in the country, they think that basically Brexit, get on with it, you know, we're not paying that much attention to minutiae of the detail. That's very good for the Conservatives at the moment. It becomes more of an issue as the Parliament goes on, and people go, why is my local hospital struggling so much? And you can't go, oh, actually, we've been extremely busy with Brexit, because that's not... People have not been tuned into that process at all. Like, that is not an excuse that will wash with people if they feel that public services have degraded in quality.
Yeah, no, I agree.
Good. Well done, Political Journalist of the Year.
You've been listening to the New Statesman podcast with me, Stephen Bush, my colleague Helen Lewis. It's recorded by India Bork and produced by Caroline Crampton. Our music is Devil by the Devil, licensed under Creative Commons. If you're looking for another podcast to add to your collection, check out Seriously. They take pop culture very, very seriously.
Normally, being a little extra can be a bit much, but when it comes to healthcare, it pays to be extra. And United Healthcare makes it easy with Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they supplement your primary plan, helping you manage out-of-pocket costs without the usual requirements and restrictions like deductibles and enrollment periods. So when it comes to covering your medical bills, you can feel good about being a little extra. Visit uh1.com to find the Health Protector Guard plan for you.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.